do today is we are going to look at the steps. I don't know how many people are familiar with what's in the actual end consent plan about this. It's just two pages that we minimise it down to, because there's a lot to go in the end consent plan, and we do hope actually maybe to have a methodology book that will be brought out in the not too distant future. But really the focus of the energy consent plan is what we're going to do, not how we did it. So that's why that's so minimised. But what we're going to do is go through those eight steps today in sort of some detail, as I say, working with you, looking at some of the tools that we applied. And we're going to go kind of in that order. Sean has actually, as people probably aware, developed the timeline, the book that's there, which was the, really, for me, a lot of the guidance that was I used in the early stages of developing the EDAP. So Sean's going to take on this first part to just talk about how we actually create that framework. So this is step one.
Thanks.
Every question, are we going to take anything away from this? Have you got any handouts or materials? Or I'm just wondering how much notes I should be taking.
Well, you can certainly have all our slides.
Yeah,
and the slideshow that Jackie was just showing as you came in. In terms of this whole workshop.
Yeah, the other thing is that because the EDAP is online, the eight steps are there to just be downloaded. It's just two simple pages, actually. So just take notes as you feel like it, but if there's anybody has any questions afterwards, things they can't remember or they want clarity on. And has this been recorded? I think it's been recorded,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's actually being recorded anyway, what we're saying and doing.
And is
feel free to kind of come back up to
topthecdap.org.uk?
Yes.
Yeah, so you can see the whole topthecdap online there.
Yeah, but the specifics about the methodology, because as I say, aren't really spelt out at this stage. Feel free to ask questions.
Okay. So it was great to hear lots of people who've started engaging with EDAPs, and also lots of people who've started engaging with EDAPs and had trouble, because, you know, a big transition thing is celebrating our failures as much as our successes and trying to learn from that. And of course, all transition stuff carries the cheerful disclaimer that we're making it up as we go along. We've got some big problems. We want to get together and talk about these problems in our communities and with each other. But, you know, we're finding out what works and what doesn't, and we're reinventing it. So remember that EDAPs aren't just, you know, aren't just works in progress themselves, but the very idea of an EDAP is a work in progress and one that's evolving. So the very first EDAP, as many of you will be aware, was a project at Kinsale Further Education College, where Rob Hopkins was working back in 2005, and he and his students watched, was it End of Suburbia, I think?
Yes.
Yeah, and were so terrified by it and flabbergasted by it, they decided to do this energy consent action plan, looking at how the community could adapt in different ways. But it was just a student project at that stage. And one of the things that birthed the transition movement really was the fact that suddenly they stuck this online and thousands of people started downloading it from around the world, and started thinking, well, there's something really important here that isn't being addressed in society. And that's available to download as well. If you just type in Kinsale EDAP, you can find that online. Then, of course, a couple of years later, when the transition movement had kicked off, and there were various communities, which I know some of you represent, who were moving along, Rob produced this book, The Transition Handbook, which really laid out, I'm sure most of you have read it, and all of you, which really laid out the methodology of transition, how to go about creating a transition tab, and the initial 12 steps process, which, as you know, is evolving now, hopefully, into this pattern language idea. And, of course, the 12th step of that 12-step process is creating an EDAP, and started to talk in very vague terms about what that might look like. And then as some of the individual communities tried to grapple with this process and what it might actually look like, some of the feedback that was coming into the Transition Network, which is the charity that existed at this stage, was this is quite difficult. And one of the reasons it's difficult is that we know about our local situation and we can plan our local future, but there are things which are going to affect us but which we maybe can't really affect. So things like climate change and peak oil, but also things like national policy decisions or national food supply, you know, all these big issues which it's really hard for Lewis, say, to actually affect, but which are going to impact a lot on the community. And so the piece of research which ended up being my book was to really look at the trends around these big scale issues. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute, and do a piece of future scenario planning, looking at different possibilities of how that could pan out, and creating a framework for local EDAPs to sit within. So there were really three origins to my book, and the first was what I've just talked about. The second was really, for me personally, a concern about is transition really grappling with full scale of the issues that we face. You know, are we just kind of making ourselves feel better by doing some nice stuff in our communities, or are we really getting to grips with the scale of the problems? And that was something which I really wanted to explore, and which I was able to do through this. And the third was really trying to flesh out the transition vision and make it something that's really real to people, that they can really feel and experience and jump out of bed in the morning wanting to make a reality. So for those of you who haven't seen it, the second half of the book actually is looking at the very latest evidence at the time on climate change and on peak oil, and particularly on how they interact with each other, which is my sort of academic speciality. And particularly focused on the UK and what's already happening in terms of those issues and what's likely to happen as we move forward. But then the part that I'll be focusing on now is around the different visions that exist in our culture about the future. And also Rob Hopkins contributed a chapter on specific tools for communities to use in doing visioning and EDAP work in their communities. So the reason why I think visions of the future are so critically important is that we talk a lot about issues like peak oil, like climate change. For those of you at Stoneleigh's talk last night about financial crisis, all of these issues, and they're incredibly important. They are absolutely things which are not getting nearly as much say, as much not being talked about nearly as much as they should be. But it's also important to think about where these problems came from. I mean, climate change and peak oil aren't a product of nature or God creating too many fossil fuels or too few fossil fuels. I mean, really, it's a case of how we've reacted to the situation in which we found ourselves, what we've decided is important, the ways that we've prioritised things, the ways that we've used and exploited our resources. And that comes down to our stories of what life's about. And you can see the power of stories in the way we teach our children using nursery rhymes, for example, or the way politicians come out with grand narratives either to inspire you to vote for them or to scare you into voting for them often. And so stories have a really powerful role in shaping our collective choices and indeed our actions. And our cultural narratives shape that a lot. I mean, an example would be the narrative of technological progress and the idea that this is the most advanced civilization has ever been and that human ingenuity will inevitably overcome any issues that we face. And that's embedded in so much of the culture, in the films, in the plays that we see. And if you come from that perspective, it's really easy to see why something like transition can look like an enemy, because you think, well, I know that ingenuity will overcome everything. So if someone's telling me I have to cut back or I have to, you know, respect natural limits, well, obviously they've got some agenda because, you know, there's no such thing. So these stories are really important in shaping the way that we see the future and also see other people and other actors. So what I did was I went and talked to a lot of people, not just within transition, but all kinds of people about their ideas of the future. And really those ideas fitted really neatly into three categories, it turned out. And the first was this idea of sort of denial, if you like, the idea that the future's basically going to carry on the same, that tomorrow will roughly look like today. And the idea is that, you know, we see this in government policy documents. You know, this is what's happened so far, so this is what will happen over the next 20 years. It's a really deeply embedded idea that basically anyone who tells you things are going to be radically different in any way at all is a bit of a nutter. And the second story that is very prominent in our culture is the sort of doom story, which I call hitting the wall, that for whatever reason, whether it's nuclear holocaust or religious apocalypse or Terminator or the Age of Stupid, you know, for whatever reason, you know, we're going to face some kind of comeuppance, and you know, that's the future that we have in store for us. And again, we see that all around our culture. And the third is, as I mentioned, the sort of techno-utopia, our inevitable future is going off colonising the stars and science and ingenuity will conquer all. And again, not at all hard to come up with lots and lots of examples of that. But it's very easy to see why this is much more appealing than the other two. It's very easy to see why people have a real emotional attachment to this. It's a much, much more positive vision. The problem with it, of course, is that certainly in the short term, it's not realistic. You can't solve today's energy problems with tomorrow's new technologies. And these things are happening right now. And so what we tried to do in this book was flesh out the realistic positive vision of transition, which doesn't really have that cultural cachet. It's much harder to think of examples of it from our popular culture. But when we tried to do that, when we tried to define it, I think it was either... maybe at a conference 2 years ago, we ended up with this statement of the transition vision. in our future we create a resilient, more localised society which avoids the worst potential of climate change and peak oil through building thriving, lower energy communities teeming with satisfied lifestyles and fulfilled people. And that vision is something that we can really get excited about and really feel like we want to build, but it's not ignoring the realities of our time. So I'll go through it very quickly, but in the book we look at that with regard to all these different areas. And for each of these different areas, look at the current trends, so the research that the communities were asking for on what has happened in UK food and water situation over the past 20 years, what's happened in travel and transport, what's happened in energy, and what are the cultural stories that we've been holding to that have shaped that set of actions so far, and then how do those stories need to shift to achieve the kind of vision that we were just talking about, and then laying out a vision of how that could happen at the national and global scale over the next 20 years to try and make it feel like something very tangible and something within which local EDAPs can sit. And so this graph, I think, when I read back through the book, which was a very different experience to writing it after it was published, this seemed to really sum up the whole ethos of all the areas. I found that when you looked at food and water, energy, healthcare, the same story really underlay all of them. We had this huge energy bonanza and we piled it into doing things in a much more energy intensive way, and it gave us some initial big benefits, but then those kind of tailed off, and now we need to respect the limits that we're coming up against. And this is a very old concept, the idea, as consumption increases here, fulfillment increases there. Obviously, initially, you need a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of resource in order to survive and then to become comfortable. But then there is a sense that as we continue to increase more, there comes a point of luxury where you're not really getting much increase in happiness for the increased resource expenditure, and even extravagance, where you start getting less and less satisfied, where you get the sense that, your possessions are starting to own you. I had a great quote the other day, never own so much stuff that it would be a relief if your house burnt down. And so this point of enough, for a long time, this is something that, the ancient Greeks talked about. This is a very old concept, this idea of enough, and then focusing perhaps on things like on family relationships, on spiritual fulfillment, on these kind of higher levels of fulfillment. But of course the modern twist on this ancient story is that now it's not just a case of, in some sort of esoteric sense, it might be a better idea to get by with less. Now it's the case that if we carry on this way, not only is it much less satisfying, it's possibly the end of the world. And so really we have this sort of balance between, on the one hand, would I like to be less happy and not have a future, or would I like to be more happy and have a future? And it's a really difficult call. And this quote, just to finish up, really sums up, I think, the transition ethos. We act as though comfort and luxury are the chief requirements of life, when all that we need to make us really happy is something to be enthusiastic about. And I think that's what transition really grasps, is that actually getting on with doing something and feeling positive and meaningful in our lives is what we actually want. So now leading into what Jackie's going to be talking about, how do we help to make that happen? Well, firstly, we have to know the reality of our times. We have to recognise the facts that I was just alluding to. And we have to know and recognise the dominant stories, because they are what's going to keep being thrown at us all the time as we try and do this work. People are going to be coming at us from those points of view, and we need to understand that and be able to identify that and speak to that. And then we need to flesh out alternative stories, which is the work this book tried to do. And something Chris Martinson, who some of you might know, produced a thing called The Crash Course. I met up with him recently, and he was saying, stories are powerful. Stories are persuasive when they're explanatory and they're predictive. If the world doesn't make sense to someone, and you can give them a story that suddenly makes them go, oh, I get it, that's what's going on, I see that now, that's very persuasive. Equally, if you can say, this is what's going to happen in the future, and then it comes true, that's very persuasive. So the kinds of stories we tell are very important. And also, the other thing that I really came to learn through doing the book was that the story we tell about our future is not the future that story brings us. Which is, so for example, look at the sort of denial business as usual story of the future and the apocalypse story of the future. You'd think, well, the apocalypse story sounds worse, but actually in terms of the future it leads to, it might be a bit better, because at least if you think we're all doomed, you might make some kind of preparations for that, whereas if you think everything's just going to carry on swimmingly exactly the same way, you're probably going to walk blind into what's coming. So always remember that the story that you're telling is not necessarily the reality that you're creating. So fleshing out those stories and building compelling visions, both globally and locally, so they're not just visions, but they're actually realities that we can see. And then these are really, I think, the two functions of an EDAP. Building a really compelling vision, and then planning to make that vision a reality. Those are the two functions, and we'll talk a bit about the relative importance of each of those in different contexts later, I think. And of course, step five is doing, actually going and as far as possible trying to create the future that we want to live in. I ended on a quote which I think is from the handbook originally, but when Aurora found it, Victoria Safford said, "Once you've glimpsed the world as it might be, as it ought to be, as it's going to be, however that vision appears to you, it is impossible to live compliant and complacent anymore in the world as it is." And I think that is the sort of rallying cry for the work that we're doing, which leads on beautifully to Jackie's work in the Energy Descent Action Plan, and some talk about the assumptions that we either share or don't share in this room about the future.
Okay, so, well, having kind of grasped a lot of the actual structures and framework and ideas and thoughts that needed to kind of start this process rolling, and bearing in mind that I was actually, in terms of Totnes, on a one-year contract to sign, sort of do this, it's the magnitude is scary, and I think that's, for anybody in this room who's actually going to embark on that, it is scary, and so you've got to kind of put some kind of shape on it. But also, you need to talk to the people that can really talk to, you know, to inform you and give you some clear ideas of where they're at and what's happening. And the people I spoke to first in the community were our own transition actual theme groups working away in Totnes. And this is one of our, this was actually our health and wellbeing group having a conversation about EDAP. And I was just saying to them, well, you know, we've got to start this ball rolling. I got a handle on what they were doing, the projects they were working on, the kind of people that they were talking to, the kind of numbers of people in their groups. And by going to all the different groups, I got a real grasp of what was going on with them. I also talked to some of the kind of movers and shakers in the town. Now, I was relatively new to Totnes at the time, in fact, very new. And so I talked to people that I was advised to talk to, and there was a kind of a district councillor who's very involved in TTT as well as being a very good district councillor. There was a guy who's the chairman of the local development trust. There was somebody involved in the strategy group. It was about 8 or 9 people. It wasn't a huge number, but I had kind of a couple of hour conversations with each of them to really listen to where they felt planning was going, you know, how this could plan out, how they saw what transition was doing, what it meant for them. And their opinions were very diverse. Some of them were very negative, some of them were very positive, some of them were saying, well, it's just kind of might work, might not, but, you know, so, it, you know, in some ways I was actually more put off by the end of that process. At the same time, I was actually gathering a lot of real information, really useful information, about what was the processes that were going on in town, who were the key people, and you know, some of the key things that were happening that I should be mindful of, especially over the next few years, which would be quite important. What I also needed to get a good grasp of was who the actual rest of the community is, how it's structured. So what kind of key community groups are there, who's in these groups, who I could actually find people I can go and give talks to, whether or not it was wasting my time or whether these would probably be really useful people to go and give talks to. So it was getting a real feel of it. Now, many of you probably would be much more long-term in your communities than I was in Totnes when I started that process. So you probably have a lot of that information already under your belt. And it's really, really useful information to know the community. But one of the guys who spoke to me very clearly was the chairman of the Development Trust. And he said, what you really need is a business plan. He said, I want to see a business plan from you in the next couple of weeks. He said, which really draws this into a very tight position of how you're going to do it. You've got a year, you've got a very short time, you've actually lost a month already. So it was, you know, and it was a very useful bit of information. I haven't actually got a copy of it to show you, but I couldn't supply anybody with it. And I just basically did it just like a normal business plan. It had 5 strands. And the first one was this framework, that, you know, the kind of stuff that Sean's been talking about. But it also looked at research that I needed to do. So I had some really clear information that I could actually share with people. It also looked at where we might find indicators, the kind of indicators that would show progress as part of the EDAP that should be included in there. But also, again, to be specific, not to find that we got so bogged down by the sheer wealth of work, because I mean you could do research in one of these things for 3 years and just have a body of research at the end of it, not actually have a plan. So there was this kind of constant cranking up of time behind me. Second one was really about looking how I was actually going to get the information from the community. So as I say, just a little bit like I described there, who I was going to talk to and what that, where that would lead us to, and how it would create some kind of idea of the plan, but also maybe a vision, the first vision, really, the vision of what the EDAP itself would look like. And then how I was actually going to get reach out to people, how was I going to promote and publicise not only the plan itself, but the process of actually engaging the community. And I'm very, very aware, one thing I have had a lot of experience with is consultation through the Local Agenda 21 process. I've done a lot of this. I was actually involved with Rob in Ireland, so I was familiar with that. And so I really wanted, I knew that anybody in the community to be engaged in this also had to be engaged very early. It wasn't a question of creating a plan and then trotting it out to a few people, you know, 9 months down the line. People had to be engaged from the word go. So I had to kind of plan in the events that were going to be to the, for the public consumption and engagement in the process, and where I would be bringing it back to them for their kind of their input and their thoughts and their views. And I had to kind of be a bit confident as well that I was going to be running around with a lot of very raw stuff and to explain myself, but saying to people, well, actually, this is what I'm doing, but what we need to know is what your response is. You know, this is always, this is very untouched, it's very raw, it's very open to shaping by yourselves, the community, people that want to be involved, and constantly making it really clear that everybody was welcome in this. And then the last strand really was my budget. I had a £500 budget to kind of roll out the work. I mean, I had my wage, if you like, my full-time fee, but it was a £500 budget for the year, so not including the printing, of course, but for leaflets, postcards, whatever else I was going to do, workshop venues, bits of paper, and a contribution. No, sorry, it wasn't 500, 5,000, my apologies, 5,000. Yeah, sorry. I'm not very good on the notes, but anyway, yeah, so it was £5,000. It was more substantial. But nevertheless, it doesn't go very far once you start hiring out the Civic Hall for £100 a throw, or wanting to do a cheese and wine and pay for some wine another £100 and do a few of those events.
Were you full-time?
I was full-time, yeah, full-time. Actually, it was like, you know, 7 day a week full-time, but paying full-time. You know, the one, you know, we're all pretty good at that. Sorry, yes.
You mentioned Local Agenda 21. What's the Local Agenda 21 which you could fall upon?
Not really, no. It obviously had been through the local authority, but it hadn't really dropped down. The only real kind of side of that, if you like, was Friends of the Earth. There's a local Friends, South Ham's Friends of the Earth, which was bigger than Totnes. But but it wasn't really, no, there wasn't a process where there was forum, except for the strategic partnership, which is to say would be through the local authority at the district council level. But they were kind of, you know, key players rather than really engaging the community as such. Sorry, did you?
Can you just read back on the five strands?
Or I can send you the business plan. Would you like me? I can. Yeah. I can make a little few bits together that people can avail of. Okay, it might be easier for you because it's more detailed. So that was a kind of the starting point. But I was very conscious of the fact that what I needed some visual things that people could start reading about it. So the first thing within the first 6 weeks, we had this leaflet. You can pass them around, actually. Just take some. Which really wasn't just for the outside community, it was also to engage the groups. So it was the first thing I really talked about groups was like, well, this is what I'm doing, and you know, I wanted them to feel consulted on what the text was and what the divisions were that were coming into that. So I was engaging the groups already, because obviously they were quite busy, like a lot of our theme groups in transition activities are very busy. They're busy doing their projects, but they really needed to be engaged in this, and they also needed to be engaged into the joined up sort of side of it. I mean, I think that was very apparent to me at the word go, that there wasn't, although people knew what other people were doing a bit, they were very focused on like their building and housing group or their food group or their energy group. So I was actually acting as a kind of a liaison between that in many ways. So I think that was quite good for the actual organisation itself.
Two quick questions. Did you do this yourself?
When
it
came yeah.
From? Okay. You weren't on your own, obviously. You had like a team of people, like a board of trustees, if you like, overseeing you. How did that work? Who was on that?
Rob actually was my kind of line manager, Rob Hopkins. So, you know, he was there. But as you imagine, Rob's pretty busy. So, you know, we met about once every couple of weeks for about an hour and a half. And, you know, I also have access to Rob, so that's if I need it.
Was it really one person, or was there like more like a board of trustees, kind of like a group?
And then there's a board. There was a project group that had been put together about eight months before I came on board, who actually went through the kind of the selection process for employing me as well, and they had been meeting as a group to kind of get a sense of how this actually was going to happen as well. But there wasn't really a huge amount for me to use from that, except that there was that body of people, and actually because they were all really busy people, it was very, very difficult to pull them together for more than three times over the period of the year, actually, to actually just, you know, run things past them. I mean, I could email like you do, you know, and say what do you think of this, but they were all busy people. So although yes, there was that structure, there was that framework, there was a group of people who met a couple of times, very usefully. I mean, after about 4 months, we did a swap on kind of where we got to, you know, the SWOT analysis, just to see how it seemed to be coming along and see where there might be a few weaknesses. And, you know, so we did kind of identify a few things that needed to kind of be a bit more. One of the things really was, and I think you've said it, is about support. You know, I was really kind of fairly unsupported, but then I'm fairly active and I'm quite good at being self-motivated, and because really the conversations I was wanting to have were more with people and engaging them in that kind of almost like a pyramid structure. You know, I was grabbing the kind of the theme groups, the project people, and then the wider community as quick as I could and running it with them all the time. So I was engaging in this wider group. So really that was the support I was more looking for, to kind of draw them into the project, rather than the mentoring, which, as I say, Rob's very good on things. And there were certain things. There was, for example, there's the Transition Tales project that TTT has, and I found that really useful. I found that really useful for tools, for kind of working. Actually, I went out to the work that they did in the schools, so I could see how they were actually doing that, and how some of the techniques that are used. And, you know, I'm no expert on a lot of those techniques because I've just used a few. But, I mean, and I know there's a lot of people probably in this room who've got a lot of those techniques as well, and I think that would be a really useful thing to have as a part of a toolkit that we could maybe, as a, you know, as a transition network, develop. I'm just watching our time here because I think we break for tea in not too distant, you know, past three, is it? So, yeah. Okay. Because what we wanted to do with you, as I said at the beginning, was really to try out go through some of the techniques. So that's the kind of, you know, that's the starting point. Really, the first thing was, as I say, step one was the framework. Step two is key tools. I recognise key tools. So the leaflet was one of them. I think this is the last one of the postcards. I got these printed up, and I used them. I actually started off by getting this as a postcard, as an invitation to the launch. We had the launch 3 months after starting the project. And this was just like a vision of what I'll pass it around. Don't grab it, because it's my last one. But we used that as a postcard that had the invitation information, which we posted out to all the kind of key people. There was 500 done as an invitation. But I found that for an extra fiver, I could get an extra 500 printed without anything on the back. So I did that as a get involved. And so we used that as a handout, and we gave it away at market stands, and some of them we sold to make a bit of money as well. So that was another one of the tools. And the other tool really was that I felt that a lot of people said to me, whatever you do, don't go to groups with PowerPoints, because people in the street don't want that. Sorry.
Yeah. That's a really good question.
Yeah.
Somebody has to design this evening. Yeah. Do you have somebody in place lately?
One of the people that have been used to doing the other, the little events leaflets that we had with TTT, I just used that guy. So, yeah, he came up with the logo, which was an extension of the transition logo, because I felt it was important to have an identity for the project. But also, yeah, he laid it out. But the wording was really what we created in-house. So, to avoid the kind of the thing of just aimless PowerPoints, what we did was I used these boards so that people who came along to public workshops and events, and again, I used the theme groups to help me decide what should be on these, the way that we've got these boards laid out behind you, the timeline, these boards would be kind of laid out so you could literally walk your way through a PowerPoint, and you can see these. I mean, they're very simple stuff, really, a lot of it. But, I mean, some of them are bigger, some of them are smaller that I've used. I mean, so these are not that one, some of them are recycled, but it was just a really useful set of being able to lay out like as almost an exhibition. And then once people had come, they'd had a chance to have a bit of a read through. A bit like as if when you came in, you know, that thing's rolling so that you kind of get a little bit informed. And then start, you know, walk my way literally through the talk. But it gave people the opportunity to go back on some of the material that I would have covered. It was a way of speeding up the process, but also it actually gave information that people could kind of access fairly easily and take photographs of
or whatever. So it was I felt that was quite useful. A lot of people said that they really quite enjoyed having those. I mean, there's a whole series of them here that are very welcome to look through. I mean, there's a lot of things that you're familiar with, things around peak oil, a lot of it's obviously slides. And then also talking to people about where are we coming from for this. And yeah, sorry, that's something I should have just said, that part of the framework was to decide the locality, and that's a really key part for any EDAP. When your starting point is working out, you know, define your geographical locality. And I came into Transition Town top mess, but in fact, when I was given the old community plan as one of my starting points, it was top mess in district. So I said, well, where's this, you know? And it's the old Coastal Market Town Initiative, which defined market towns according to their economic activity, probably dating back to something like the 18th century. And so I picked out that adjoining 15 parishes, so it became a 16 parish energy descent plan, not one parish. And that was very critical. It actually upped the numbers from 8,500 population in Totnes to 23,500 as that bigger population included those rural areas. But it gave us the hinterland. When we were talking about where we were going to grow our food, we weren't going to do it out of window boxes in Totnes. We had to have something about those areas around. And those people had to be involved in the process. It would have been very unreasonable in every which way, and it wouldn't have been a meaningful plan to have decided something when you can't empower those people. So anyway, you can have a look at those in the break if you wish. But they was, you know, it's cheap and cheerful. Bits of old cardboard, you know, you can recycle the back, you can show the front and the back, you can use them in different ways to different people. But it really was something that a lot of people responded very positively to. So the next stage really was then, when we were talking to the groups, was to say, well, let's get this process going with our groups and also practice run, if you like, for running it out into the wider community. We talked about, well, what are the assumptions that we actually start this? You know, how do we build the information? How do we build a new story? If we, you know, what assumptions are we on? And it's a very interesting example, and I just want to do this with you now, okay? So this is practice run. So if you were kind of thinking about what would be the, you know, the politics, I mean, we just had a change now, but the politics of going into that next 5 years, the next 10 years, the next 20 years, you know, what do you think might happen with the population? What do you think is, I mean, I think we're probably an unusual bunch, but what do you think is going to happen with climate change in the next 20 odd years? What do you think is going to happen with the economy? How's the economy? Is it going to rise, fall, change, going down? So call out what you think. I mean, don't tend to be kind of joke public. Call out what you think, because I'm obviously going to get an unusual bunch. But get the conversation moving, particularly maybe on the population a bit, perhaps not one that we're always covering in transition towns.
Increase.
You reckon it's going to increase?
I reckon it might move from urban areas to rural areas.
It's becoming older.
The migration from Mediterranean northwards to more temperate areas as the climate change deteriorates.
And lowlands as well to highlands.
Sorry?
And lowlands to highlands.
So you face an immigration problem.
I think it could be good. Climate change on the mining or agriculture.
A lot of people think there's going to be economic collapse, you know, even in the short term, with this, you know, national interest of a coalition may not, may trigger a second recession.
Does anybody challenge any of those assumptions?
I think some of the implications, when we talk about climate change and economic collapse, they become words that we hear a lot in the media, and therefore they kind of, strange phrase, but it kind of vanillarizes everything. I think concentrating some of the smaller things we take for granted, giving an example in all of the snow that we had after the winter, and there was no money from local governments to fix roads. So as climate change has more kind of sinister effects on us, those are the sort of symptoms we'll start to see appearing, and then things that actually become very connected to us directly and visceral, they affect us directly. It's not something you just hear about on TV. And I know it seems quite significant, maybe something like that, but there'll be lots of things like that. So, for example, import market can just fall over, and then you start to face those problems of the country running out of food in 3 days. And so, there's lots of really interconnected systemic effects that affect us and our families and locations.
If in the next 20 years there is significant financial followed by social collapse, our expectations of health may have to change, right? We may not be able to expect of the health service what we currently take as normal. And there could be a greater mortality rate that may or may not affect populations, because you could get migration to fill the gaps that the mortality has created.
And this employment will have significantly changed, I suspect, in that there may be much less paid employment than there is now.
Well, this assumption leads to the point that more critical questions are for development and our current prevailing development model, which opens the opportunity of change.
So how do you think the political response will be to this?
Failure to know what to do and then it's going to happen and open up to us whether they'll have the structures to allow and support that and whether the bureaucracy will cope. The bureaucracy is almost more critical than the government. The government can set work like that. The bureaucracy goes and they can't on this thing.
I think the initial reaction will be anger. No, population. Because that we're not being given what we had expected for our previous lives. So there'll be blame and anger before there is acceptance that this is the new norm and we better get on with it.
Look at the Greek riots.
I suspect the establishment will give a few concessions, but only those needed to stop any serious social unrest.
But, sorry, the Greek riots are refusing to accept the military.
Yeah, that's what As long as they can, they do.
I think the societies, which may be the case if we don't get a constant collapse where it happens more incrementally, where food prices just continue to go up, we'll see that the speeding up of existing trends, like more people doing more planting, more local activism, which is on our side. And I think that there will be more waste people, and that's our battleground, really. That's where we should be out there harvesting those people and helping them to into usefulness.
Yeah. But do you think that'll happen?
I think it will happen. I think people are, there's already a consciousness, I'm quite surprised by that. In fact, doing it together is much more functional than doing it on your own. But I also think that the examples, Cuba, for instance, Argentina, when the currency collapses, 5,000 local currencies just sprang up because they were functionally necessary for things to move. And that's one of our big threats. If liquidity disappears, we can't do almost anything in modern society is set up to do. So we have to find alternative ways of doing it.
In that three-stage process, we went from the Great Court. The group I was in, we came to the conclusion that there would become a realization, and then, rather like in the Second World War, there'd be a calmness about getting on with it, because there was no alternative. It's a question of when that point comes, and then people collectively work together to do it. I hope we will do that.
Just carry on with the idea of assumptions. If we can just like. When I took them to the public workshops, just to give you some ideas how it worked out, they were themed workshops. So, for example, we would then do assumptions on what we think is going to happen to building and housing. So we can move into that.
And ask us that thing in lots of areas, growing inequalities between sort of those people who still manage to hold on to resources. And those that don't, whether it's a pretty severe economic shock or just sort of increasing differences in society.
So just thinking about building and housing?
I think there's a tendency for people to call them into a mindset sort of where you play and like you're going to collapse. I think it's more likely we go into a sort of period of stagflation and inertia, and government policy to write reports, commission reports about things rather than actually doing anything about them. And I think that will continue because if there isn't any money to spend on solutions, there is actually more resilience within the system than people give it credit for. I survived a whole number of shocks in the past. You know, 1973, I remember when the lights went out, we go to school, there wasn't any petrol in the petrol station. You know, I thought it had become a distant memory deal.
It was a big missed opportunity.
More resilient.
In terms of housing, I think that as energy prices go up, people will start to get really focused on creating and, you know, making themselves more shipshape with, you know, small amounts of money. And then hopefully there'll be grants for other things like solar PV and so on.
But how about the way we live? Do you think people will be changing the way we live? Because, I mean, if cement is very energy high, you know, demanding. So if we can't build much more, how's that going to be going if we're increasing our population?
I don't think population will increase. I think we'll retrofit our houses, and I think we'll sort of cram more people into the housing stock that we have.
Okay.
Will we not see, if there is austerity, there will be an amount of deregulation which will ease people's minds and play a little bit of freedom from this rigid control structure we have.
I think this will be there might be quite a shift in especially home ownership and cost of housing, which at the moment is crippling this country, I think. And I think there's also incredible opportunity there. There's lots of people are kind of unable to continue paying their mortgages, for example, unable to continue paying their rent. I think that's going to help to create a big shift. And I think there's an opportunity there to really steam in with different models of, for example, win-win solutions based on community ownership of housing. I can see a lot more community ownership of housing in years to come, and I think there needs to be.
I think one important thing is it might first like actually to consider that the answers will be different depending on the context they are asking these questions. So we need to normally they're not bothered very much because they obviously bother with wood. We don't have the oil prices as such because they are almost 100% of the energy market. In other communities or in other geographic contexts, there might be issues with democratic and things like that. But again, it's really also important in the local context. So there are much of the interesting things about local communities and how it's happening.
I'm just going to take two more because
If I could use an example of what's already happening and take the Pembrokeshire National Park as an example. About 2 years ago, they were all full of, I don't know if you've heard about the roundhouse that Tony Wrench built up with them up, but they were all for taking it down because it was nicer. And they had an epiphany equipment. And now they have granted permission for 40 roundhouses to be built in woodland that is owned by a raw back that's related to this problem. And there's this sort of revolution to think that from going totally against do-it-yourself type roundhouse building with straw bales and things like that, to actually helping people who want to live in a simple lifestyle to do this. And hopefully that, having converted that organisation, it will develop and give an example that people can quote or set precedent for it to be done. And that is a very sustainable form of creating places for people to live.
In Australia, already with the climate change that's happening and the drought and the water shortages, there's talk of our population doubling by 2050. So there's a lot of talk already around, which means that the concerns we have for the way housing is being built at the edges of suburbia and continuing, Melbourne used to be the second biggest city for spread, and it's probably going to go back to that position very soon. So there's all sorts of talk around that and concern for it, but there isn't much talk about how we can stop it, because that's the direction we're heading in.
Thank you. One, I don't know if people have witnessed this, and maybe because I've seen it sort of like an extended version, but one thing that I've found with doing the assumptions work is the initial rounds, it starts off very negative. It's like, ooh, you know, doom and gloom. And again, you know, we're transition people, so we kind of, you know, we're kind of thinking positive a lot of the time. So I think we're solutions thinkers. But I've found once you started to talk about it in terms of the themed area, it started to kind of sort of like makes it easier to be creative and think about positive things that can happen. It helps people to focus up a bit. And particularly things like food, for example, you know, people very quickly will say, oh, yeah, well, we can grow our food and we can do this. And the trigger memories of things that, you know, like the wartime efforts and various things that, you know, were very positive. And also, you know, even just on the housing, which is sometimes a little bit of an odd one, it starts people thinking about, yeah, we can do things differently. Mm-hmm. And that whole thing of deregulation is a very key thing that people start to think about, that, you know, the bigger things as well that kind of affect not just one area but a number of areas. I'm going to move on now, if that's okay, because I want to just talk about the launch and move us on to another activity. This was how, when Sean was talking about scenarios planning, when we initially discussed it with the groups, that's how we looked at it, but we didn't take that out to the public because it helped the groups to see how scenarios planning works. And a lot of that has come from work that Shell has done, actually. Second World War, Winston Churchill used it a lot, and then Shell picked up in the 60s to look at how they could keep their business going, is how they used it. So there's a lot, if you're interested in scenarios planning, there's a lot of work on the Shell website. There's our postcard and the leaflet. And then in September, so it was only 3 months after we started, was the launch, and that was the mayor launching the project. So we had kind of advocates. This is the chief executive of Southampton District Council, David Incull, who told us all how he had a bike. And it was very good giving me his due, but he's not very supportive at the moment in some ways that we'd really like their support to be much more embraced with it. We had a little mini drama just to engage the audience, and this was really good fun. And somebody came up with the idea that we should do a kind of an old school reunion, like set in 2030. And we got these, and the guy that's there dressed up in his helmet and shiny jacket was pretending to be an old local authority worker who'd been doing all the billeting of housing during the 2010-2012 when the housing crisis had happened. And the stories were told by the different people talking to each other at the end of about a 15-minute session with the audience, where the audience had helped them to write their story, and then they exchanged the story to the overall audience as if they were at a school reunion telling each other, well, what did you do over the last 20 years? And it was a really interesting exercise in how people do the visioning and how they get there in the steps as well. And it was great fun, because one person said, I can't possibly be on the same par with these other three because they're all much younger than me. So she said, I'll have to have been the dinner lady. So yeah, the stories of confessions of a dinner lady thrown in.
Quick one. At what point in your 1 year did you launch the project? Like 3 months or?
3 months, yeah. We started in June 2008. So, yeah.
Can I just get one clear around that? Because the audience wrote the scenario. The audience wrote what happened in the intervening 10 years, and they then told their story of their part in the...
No, sorry, I jumped that a bit quick. We had four people who agreed to be actors.
Prepared their characters before.
We prepared it to some extent, so if there was gaps in what the audience provided... That, you know, it was kind of loosely there, but it was like they were good. They were, you know, good improvisers who could kind of pick things out that people would offer that could be woven in. We also put some pieces of paper on the chairs with ideas about what was in the story. So if somebody was a bit stuck, they had a tool to be able to use. You know, somebody that perhaps wasn't very used to being forthcoming or thought what I've thought was a bit silly, so I won't say it. But they'd have a bit of paper on the chair that could say, "Oh well, you know, my disabled husband had to get a special ride, so the bus service started to come our way on a Wednesday," and things like little extra bits of the story that sound fairly odd in their isolation, but when we kind of scripted it out, they were there. But not a lot of people didn't use that. Again, being Totnes, a lot of people like doing their own thing, so it was there was a lot of kind of ad improvising and ad-libbing by the actors that we used. But we'd introduced them as a kind of who they were. You know, this is 2030, these are four people at a school reunion, and this is this guy who left school in, I think they had to have left school in 2000 or something, and they'd you know, he was a
he worked for local authority and he'd taken early retirement. He'd gone part-time and taken early retirement. This was a woman who'd had, I think, two children and blah, 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 and had now had a disabled husband, and they lived in one of the villages outside, so she wasn't living in town. There was a businesswoman who'd she got pregnant and had to leave school early, so she'd had early children early and had a quick, you know, quick marriage and a quick divorce and been a single mum, and had then gone back into becoming a very successful businesswoman, and her current job was I think selling stuff that she was selling and sending off on the train. And then the other one was a dinner lady who had been quite elderly at the time, taken early retirement, and had lived a fairly sedentary life, but actually had really got a really good garden going now. So those were the kind of starting points of the little scenarios, if you like, that people were presented with. And I tell you, like, the other one was the farmer. We had this one who had Italian by birth farmer who'd gotten into farming young, early, left school early, and then he'd his father who'd had the farm at the time, and it had just, you know, in 2010 the crash had come, and end of story. And so they'd gone back to Italy for a family funeral, and they discovered organic farming that was happening there and brought it back, that they'd been, you know, they thought this was some really good ideas to apply, and suddenly their business had really boomed. So it was, you know, there was, but it, we wove in the personal stuff as well about kind of people's lives, how they were affected, and I think that was the thing that made it entertaining for people, but also that they could bring in extra bits around the story. It wasn't just about, you know, putting, you know, putting PV on your roof. Okay, yeah. So anyway, this part, this is the piece on the left hand side there, the timeline, is the piece that's actually behind you over there. And what we did at the end of the evening, we had about a 20-minute session of writing, building the timeline, with getting people to kind of put on the various places the things that they thought would be happening. Now, again, thinking about the assumptions that you've come up with, we thought this would be quite... I don't know how many of you have ever done this building the timeline activity. So I think some of you probably have. But we've got some post-its, and we're going to invite you to actually do some timeline work for about 10 minutes and have a look and see what other people put up. What we encourage people to do is start from 2030, so, and then work backwards if you can, but if you find it difficult to have an idea of what 2030 might look like, just put things up that you think are probably going to happen at certain points along that timeline. What's interesting is that we've left the first board off now, because it started in 2007, and now we've scrubbed that bit. So, so we move forward on that. I'll pass some post-its.
Thank you. I can guess what these are, but could you say what the blue, the red, the...
Oh, sorry, yeah. When we did this, it was, again, it was all kind of a bit of a fast thing. And the black at the bottom is kind of oil sliding away. So that's just to represent oil declining, really. The blue rising at the back was meant to indicate community engagement and involvement and a kind of a groundswell of that. And it was meant to be kind of coloured in the middle to represent various other changes without being specific. And the red line is really just the pathway. So it was an idea of a pathway just into the future. The one that you might have seen in the book, which is quite different really, because it's got a lot of more of the framework things that Sean was talking about, and is actually a lot more attractive. And I'm hoping to get that one upgraded to look more like this, actually. This one, if you can see that. That actually hasn't got so many sections because it reflects the jumps that are actually in the timelines in the book. I don't know if people have actually looked much at the book, but every section, there's a load of sections that have got timelines, and it starts off with 1 year, but then it jumps into 3 year and then 5 year chunks, mainly because that's it's very, very difficult to kind of be specific about years once you get close up to 2030. But we wanted to make sure that this was a tool that we could use that's kind of got lots of space, so come public workshops or whatever, it's a really nice activity. And it's one thing it's really successful. I mean, you can see all the people piling across. Oh, this is Sean here, enthusiastically doing lots of post-its. But I mean, we filmed, you couldn't see that timeline. There was about 180 people at the launch. You couldn't see that timeline in about 15 minutes. It was incredible, just covered in post-its. People absolutely full of ideas. And this really was one of the starting points that only started the whole process of what's actually going to be in the EDAP. What's, you know, what kind of stuff is going to be in there? What thoughts do people have? Because this EDAP, make no mistake, reflects what people have said, what they think. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's sat and made all this up. It's actually a reflection of all these. It's all been recorded. Every post-it has been recorded.
So that gathering there followed your meeting with each of these groups to discuss with them and engage them in the idea of it.
Yeah.
And then after that, they and others were invited to this launch.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So we met with, I met with the theme groups, I met with the projects, I met with the, you know, the movers and shakers in town. Yeah. I set up as many as I could talks, which went over the whole year to various groups. And then we did the public launch 3 months into the project, just to get a lot of publicity. I mean, it was on the front page of the local paper. Yeah. It got a lot of, you know, a lot of very positive publicity. Mm. And so to really get it into the public eye that this was happening and how they could get involved. And we had big boards up for people to sign up to be involved in the workshops. It created a body of people, which was the starting point for a circulation list that I could let people know about workshops and events that were going on around the work that was doing. So that started, it was about 180. By the time I'd got about 3 months, another couple of months into the project, I had, I think, 850 names on a circulation list. Now, that wasn't people that all put themselves forward. I went through the local directory and just pulled people in that I thought would be useful. So I'll give out some post-its and some pens, and you can start doing that. If you've got some questions, feel free to ask.
I'm doing top notes to hear our community.
Transition anywhere, I think you've called yours, did you? Transition anywhere. Is that okay?
Sorry. I'm clear about why we start at the end. Are we supposed to establish in our own minds an end product and go back to create the stages that develop it?
In terms of actually feeding a vision in what process, and we'll have an exercise in a minute on that, and if you can also we can start, we can do that now. But at that launch, it was, you know, we didn't really have the time to spend time doing vision, so we did this little drama, which kind of got me into the mindset of it, and that was really a little bit of the whole timeline, rather than at the end to start off with. But if we're kind of talking about a future story, then I think for ourselves here,
you write the last page first.
Yeah.
Situate the
and that's really how the whole thing works, all the way through the process. We were always working from where we want to be, backwards. Because otherwise you're always taking small steps. And regular plans that local authorities do, and indeed most groups that are doing plans tend to be, what was the last plan we did? I mean, obviously in the old community plan, which had been done in 2005, and it was like, oh, we'll start from that. Well, there was a lot of things that hadn't been done, so you could say, well, the next plan and all those bits that didn't get done. You say, well, what's the budget? And, you know, what we expect to be doing, and what's our priorities for things to do? And you're working, looking forward. So it's very difficult to go off on a different path, because you're on kind of a path already. Whereas if you say, well, look, how are we going to get to there? That's where we want to be. Mm-hmm. Then you start working backwards. Two things in motion. One is that you actually have to dive off on that path fairly quick. But also, it's a huge amount to do. Because a lot of the thinking often is, oh, well, the oil's going to run out or whatever, it's going to run out in 5 years' time or get difficult in 5 years' time. Well, we'll have a really good party now because, you know, because that's going to happen. It's not like, well, yeah, yesterday we should have started being a bit more careful or changing our ways. So you want that to come out anyway, but in a positive vision. You want this positive sense.
I believe that, say, rural development plans, where I come, they work in about 15 year cycles.
Tends to vary, but
and inherited in there already incorporating climate change.
Okay. I think we'll just start if that's okay. Although we've got a long session this afternoon, we're actually squeezing quite a lot in. We're kind of squeezing 2 years' worth of work plus into 3.5 hours. Okay, so step five now.
In our 2 years and a half now.
All right. Okay, so get yourselves to a table.
Okay, yeah, great.
If need be, take a chair with you.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
So what we're going to do is look at some of the things that happened in the first round of the public workshops. Okay, now we talked about that's a photo taken from the front of the Methodist Church opposite TTT, where we ran a lot of the public workshops. Again, picking a venue that a lot of people are very familiar with, and felt very comfortable in. It was always kind of a bit odd working with people in queues. That wasn't too easy, but nevertheless, we were able to shift those around. As I said before, timeline was in use, and the boards were just the posters, so people could literally walk through the PowerPoint. The handout that I gave out that first round of public workshops is, there's a few copies on each of the tables, just so you can have a look. You're welcome to take those away, they're just spares that I had. And to kind of engage people into kind of things that they could do when they arrived, to give that kind of bit of time for people doing late arrivals, and so that people weren't off kilter just because they came in 10 minutes late, we did a kind of a set personal carbon calculation, which is the second page. It was a bit of an odd one. It was kind of put together by a couple of people that weren't, I mean, I worked with them, and it wasn't, but it could have been a lot simpler, so I wouldn't recommend doing one as long-winded as that. But it certainly got people talking amongst themselves around kind of working out where their, you know, what their carbon footprint was. So it was quite an interesting exercise to have that as an extra thing. Again, kind of giving something back as well for people coming to the workshops, that they could actually take something away that was useful to their, you know, lives straight away. The thing that we did at this first round of public workshops was scenarios planning. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the scenarios planning, and we looked at the slide which had it kind of divided into four, and Sean also talked about that in terms of getting really an overall framework. So where we have the kind of the idea of if we don't change and we've got a kind of a sense of peak or gloom, which is, or, you know, just put our heads in the sand, or if we go to the kind of worst case scenario of climate change chaos. On the other side of that graph was techno-fix, which is like, you know, willing to change, but, you know, the technical possibilities taking us into the future, but not necessarily helpful. And the other side of willing to change also is about transition. So to make this simpler for the public workshops, I just did it in two sides. One was willing to change, and one was business as usual. In the EDAP itself, I'll just pull this out. Sorry, I should have had this out ready. I'll show you what it's looked like from, and this was actually came from one of the workshops, this piece here. And what we did was we literally divided the sheets in half, so that very much like you've got there, sheet in front of you, the marker. We've got people to do a line down the middle, and then three concentric circles. The first one to represent 7 years out, second one to represent 14 years out, the third one to represent 21 years out, because in 2009 we were looking at 21 years to 2030. And on one side we suggested putting business as usual, on the other side willing to change. And then we picked out a theme. Now, according to what the workshop was, now, for example, when we had the education workshop, we talked about a community school, a community college, and as the kind of thing. And then we said, well, you know, think about what's that going to look like if we kind of carry on business as usual across, after, you know, within the first 7 years, within the next 14 years, or within 21 years. So you could kind of have a bit of a timeline working out. Because actually that really helped people. If you start off by just having two blank sides, it's a bit kind of, well, where do you go? Whereas if you kind of, again, give a sense of time moving out from the centre. And exactly the same with the willing to change. Now, I don't know if you can see it from there, but the one side on the left, which is business as usual, was very, very underscored. There was hardly anything in there. And on the right-hand side, there's lots of writing. You might not be able to see it very easily from where you are. I can pass that round, have a look. But that was the same for every workshop. Every workshop, it was far more coming out for the creative side of it, where we're going, than the business as usual. And I didn't know that before I started, but it was, you know, that's what came out of every workshop. So it wasn't just a fluke, because there were 9 public workshops. Yes.
Wasn't that because the people who came to your workshops were actually motivated and therefore interested in doing something about the situation?
Not entirely, no, because, I mean, these workshops started in the November, and this was 5 months into the project, during which time, as I say, I'd had the launch in the September, I'd gone out and given talks left, right and centre, I'd gone and met with secretaries of groups. Not entirely, no. I just said, we're doing this process and we need you to be engaged. And the talk that I would give would have been about, you know, really about what transition was. I mean, some of them had a few talks, but not very many. So, you know, I would say that 50% of the people attending were fairly first-timers to transition. They were the general public that we are trying to reach. And they weren't just the general public, they'd be people from, like, local authority people. And, you know, I was quite lucky, for example, the transport one, the guy who's the key engineer for highways from Devon County Council came along to that. So, you know, there was a mix of people that weren't used to coming along to transition. Yes, they were motivated because they'd taken a step in the door. But I think that, you know, at the start of the workshop, we'd have done the assumptions exercise, and then we'd have gone into scenarios planning. Now, because we were a bit behind time, what I thought would be really useful would be for each of you to kind of do the scenarios planning exercise just fairly quickly around your tables. And that's why on your tables you've got a sheet and a marker. And there's one pen, but if you need any more, I've got a few more, but I haven't got one for everybody. But just shout if you need the markers. And what I'd like you to do is get your sheet in its landscape shape. Do a line down the middle like that. Okay. On one side, I just put BAU, business as usual. On the right hand side, W2C, when you change. And then put some semicircles on either side. Use the full sheet. So you've got 7 years, 14 years. 2013. That's 2010 in the middle. That's 2030 out there. And what I'd like you to do is to, you can either use the example I'll give you, or you can pick one of yourselves. Sorry, can I just give you something here? Can everybody just quiet while we just finish this bit of information, then you can talk. I suggest that we maybe think about a community hospital as our topic. If you want to pick something else, that's fine, but just to get you started, if we think that this is a community hospital, what's going to happen to it in a future scenarios planning over that timeline of 21 years? If we're willing to change on the right-hand side, what kind of things are we going to be looking at? Just to get us started, let's have a couple of bit of dirt on the room. So within the first 7 years, say, what do you think a community hospital would look like if we're willing to change?
More dietary and preventative health, herb growing, voluntary workers.
Sorry?
Voluntary workers.
Voluntary workers.
Ensuring all food.
Okay. Right, what about business as usual?
Shutting down.
Okay.
Job losses.
Okay, you got the message. Off you go.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next exercise. I hope you've found that quite informative and a bit of practice. I've got about 1 minute if anybody wants to ask a quick question on that, just as on the technique or anything.
What happens if you're doing this with people who don't know about the transition initiative?
It works. It does. That, you know, as I said earlier, I mean, about 50% of the people coming to my public workshops as part of this process were not involved in transition. You know, and I think that, you know, and that was, you know, as I say, it was even with that, it was still one of the positive. Yeah.
But your board still give them that explanation of why change is probable or inevitable as a background to why we're thinking about doing change.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, the introduction at the public workshop was, you know, about transition and what we were doing. We also talked about assumptions as a group before we broke up into this, so we'd have covered the assumptions side and then into future scenarios. And then the final part of that first round would just be visioning and an open visioning exercise in the room, which maybe we could do actually just while I hand the next sheets of paper around, which would be just a kind of a, again in the group, bringing people back together and at the close of the workshop finishing with the vision, the idea being the next round of public workshops we worked from the vision, and that's what we're going to do in a second, is what we did on the second round. So just would like to close your eyes. I'm not going to take anything away from in front of you, but to close your eyes, this is the exercise I did with at the public workshops at the end, and I said to people to just feel really relaxed and really try hard to think about the work that we've done, the conversations we've had around
2030, you know, a long time off, what it was going to kind of starting to feel like, and their sense of where they might be and what it might smell like, and just a real sort of sense of projecting themselves forward in the future. That the next generation, and it's 20 odd years, so if they've got young children, they're going to be grown up. They might not be, you know, parent, they might be a grandparent by then. If they were particularly young, they might have a family by then. And then to imagine, kind of, you know, getting up on the morning similar to then, this was in November, so like maybe a chilly wet morning, and coming down and making the tea, maybe putting the kettle on, or maybe not, maybe doing something quite different, and looking out the window. With eyes still shut, and this is what I'd ask you to do, is now to just call out what you're seeing out that window. What's happening for you? What does it look like out the window? What kind of things do you think you're going to be doing in that day? Just that day in 2030 that we've jumped forward to. So if you'd like to just, you know, come out with a few sentences about what it feels like to you in 2030, and use whatever you want now in this real time workshop.
I'll probably be pushing up the
You know, that's usually the first comment that comes back.
Yeah,
okay, everybody else, keep your eyes shut, so it's kind of anonymous.
Joining a few neighbours, because we're all going to walk down the field where we've been hunting lately.
Lots of people cycling past on the way to various local occupations.
Cutting firewood with their hands off.
And collecting local compost for the bin in the old corner in the wood park.
Birdsong.
The chickens, but more difficult to carry the puppies.
Going down to local shops that are set up in the husks of the chain stores.
Conscious neighbourhood. People know each other and are connected.
Just jumping on because it's cold.
Visiting elderly neighbours to see if they're okay.
Going to take some bread in the community oven.
Quiet because there are no cars. Children taking part in all the activities that grown-ups do.
Wondering why the last 20 years seem to have gone by in a flash.
Working horses as opposed to tractors.
Lots of bicycle bells coming to the school across the road if the children are not.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Open your eyes. I think I understand you did some vision this morning in the main plenary area. I wasn't there, I'm afraid, so I don't know quite what you did there, but that was, you know, something that people felt they could quite easily, and you know, give it 15 minutes in a workshop so it's not too long. And, you know, most people have contributed, and it's all our different senses are addressed, which is, I think, quite interesting. Okay, so this is round two of the public workshops, and we're going to do some backcasting. And what I've given you is some little bits of paper, which are actually some of the visions. They were turned upside down, so feel free to turn them over now. Not the big bits of paper, they're little bits of paper. these are the ones that you've got here. These. Turn them over, and put them in the middle of your sheet of paper. What you would have done if you'd come to that workshop, you'd have had written visions to the theme of the workshop. Now, say, for example, it was about food. All the visions that have come from all around the public workshops, all of the work that we've done to date. And there was about, I think there was about 200 visions that came forward from different pieces of work that we did. They were all grouped, and then people could come along to the workshop and they would spend a little time picking out some of the visions they wanted to work with. Okay, now I've just given you a random few because I've obviously to cut through time. And you might want to work on one or you might want to work on all of them. Because I don't know, I've just given them out to you randomly. They may fit together and they may not. But what I want you to do is a backcasting exercise. And the backcasting exercise is the nub of how we actually generated the meat of the EDAP. And if you can see this sheet I've got here, which is like, again, landscape of your sheet in front of you. I've put 2030 in the middle, and I'd like you to put the vision or visions that you want to work on there. Then I want you to do three concentric circles out from that centre. And so the first circle ends on 20, 23, 24. The next one is 2016, far out one is 2010. And what I want you to do is, starting from the vision in the middle, start to write with pens on a piece of paper the kind of things that you would expect to have in place or happen in order for that vision to happen. So, for example, if that vision is more, you know, something about, you know, lots of, you know, cyclists around, then obviously one of the things that needs to happen is you need some more cycle lanes, probably, in your area. I know it's going to be a bit difficult because we're not all living in the same place, so we're not going to get like the local tuning, which would often come into this, which is very, very useful and very important to an energy descent plan for a given area. But just kind of keep it loose, but think about some of the main things that you need to have happened. It might help to kind of do some jumping around to start off with, a little bit like we did on the timeline, you know, jump around, well, that one has to be kind of there, and then see where you need to fill in the gaps. Again, I'm sorry about to tell you that we only really need 10 minutes for this exercise, but if we can do some backcasting, it will start to help you see how we build up that kind of timeline in the plan. And the plan itself that we have has 15 different lots of timelines because they were themed. The workshops were themed. So I don't know quite what I've given you in terms of those visions. They're just random ones that were left over from workshops. But if you just want to pick out one that might be around transport, or there might be two or three that link together that you feel relevant, or there might be one about food that you want to work on, and just use that as a starting point to kind of build towards, but actually building from. Sorry, you can ask a question.
I was just going to ask, how did you cope with situations where there were visions that people thought, well, I don't want to work towards now?
Because people chose them when they came to the workshop.
Okay.
I don't want
to be part of that vision, I'm not going to work towards it.
No, people, when they came into the workshops, there was kind of, the visions were all pinned up, you know, along that theme. And what they could do was pick them off, just literally list them off, and take them to a table and put them down. We had the sheets worked out like this with the concentric circles. Put them in the middle,
yeah.
And then you know, people could roam around, so it's kind of just a bit open space feeling as well. Then you could wander around and just sit down and think, oh yeah, I'd like to do that, or they might go and pick a vision and start a sheet themselves. So I had lots of tables and there was lots of choice, and generally people started talking to each other.
So the question is, what do you do with ones that nobody really wants?
Mm.
I mean, if someone
they were just left
vision,
over, they were just left over. What I did when I was actually drawing together the EDAP itself, I pulled those in as part of the visions that were actually at 2030, although they were perhaps, you know, they weren't overly relevant, but they were kind of left in there when we were kind of pulling it in.
So was this done in a separate workshop to the exercise we've just done?
Yeah, it was the next part. It was like the second round of workshops.
You're very welcome. I can leave these sheets out if you want to come back and carry on doing this after the workshop. You know, there's no problem with that, or any of the other parts that you've been working on together. And I don't know what you found on this, but the experience that I had at the public workshops was that this is the bit where people got very, very engaged. And in fact, I would have liked the opportunity to have had more time for people. People were working, as you can see, very small groups, very intensely. I gave 40 minutes at the workshop for this, then 20 minute tea break, and then 40 minutes into the next topic, you know, because I had double topic workshops to rush me through a little bit. And a lot of people carried on right across the tea break and then said, can we carry on with the same one? Although other people would be coming in for the next part of the workshop. So it was, you know, it was very intensive. But I think what's really important about this is what really feeds the timelines. In the EDAP itself, the meat of the timelines is based on this. And when I was actually scripting it together, I could have done with an awful lot more information to use. And it is such, I don't know how you found it, but it becomes a very, very creative process.
So from your experience, how long do you actually align with it?
I would give 1 hour sessions, because I think 1 hour is enough for people actually in very intensive work. But you know, you could do 2 hour workshops where you have 1 hour or 2.5 hour workshop, half an hour break, and then another hour. You know, but just more of them, really. You know, more of them, and you take them around. And you know, again, although we're all kind of transitioners in this room, so that in that sense we're kind of ideally one step ahead. But actually, once people start this conversation, and this is the thing about working in the groups like this. It's people are sharing ideas and starting to see where each other are coming from. And we've all got local information. However, we might be doing something completely different to transition. We've all got local information that keys into this, which of course is, you know, if in community engagement, I thought this was one of the most useful processes actually, and certainly something I'd like to see develop more in terms of techniques that we could apply. How you kind of get, you know, some of the things that could kind of come in and make the visioning, build on the visions that people have created. Because these visions, what I found was that there was a lot of soundbite visions rather than more drawn out visions, and I think that kind of makes it a bit difficult on one level. On another level, we compensate with the backcasting perhaps, but that was, you know, that was my experience. That's all I can share.
How many people came to the second round of workshops?
Well, there were 9 altogether, and there was always about 30 people, but sometimes they would kind of be about 50 at a workshop because there'd be kind of swap overs the way people come and go. So what's that, 9-3 is, you know, over 200 people basically. So it was a lot of people informed the EDAC. And the next stage was that, and I'm just going to run this through verbally now because of time. That's what at once, I used post-its because a lot of people who weren't very familiar with each other found it easier to write their little post-it and just stick it on and then move it afterwards. Post-its gives you a bit more variation. But those ones, this was the lesson of this workshop, of course, never use old post-its because they all fell off the timeline. I'm sorry about that. But anyway, recycling at its worst, or reuse. One of the ways of getting people engaged in the second set of workshops was to have some film shows. I did The Power of Community. I don't know how many of you here are familiar with that film, but good film, useful film. You know, I've used it loads of times. Somebody offered a different workshop to just kind of do about systems building. This was his Atkinson Accelerator, which you may have heard of. And there they were at the end, having built the pyramid. And that they were all transition people, by and large. But it was a great experience. So, and I think that would be a message for me, is if people offer stuff as part of your process, be open to it, because it'll bring other people in and it engages people who've perhaps got something else to offer, a slightly different way of looking at things.
Did you invite people at the beginning when you were designing this to share processes with you?
Yes. Very much so. I said, well, this was the main one, really. This was one of the guys, actually, who's a director of TTT, who's involved in this. He's one of the Barefoot Partnership, so we were fortunate. But, there were various things that did get offered. It was more around kind of where I could go out to people and do talks, really. But, you know, I just said, look, we're listening. Whatever you come up with, you know, we can listen and see if we ideally fit it in. If we can, we will. If we can't, we'll look at maybe adding it on later on. So, yeah, there was a sense, I hope, of full openness.
Just on logistics, at the end of each workshop, do you literally collect up every bit of paper?
Yeah, what I did, which was helpful, I took photographs. I just laid them on the floor and photographed everything.
Right.
So that if stuff fell off, I didn't have to worry so much about it.
And then, so literally, then that all feeds in, then you would then collate all that.
Plenty of typing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you have an army of helpers, or did you do it
on the website? I did a lot of typing. Sorry.
Yeah, the logistics of this, were they held during the day, evening, weekends, whole days?
That's a really good question, actually. It needs to be locally tuned. The first round, I did a little bit of experiment. I did a community one. I did two community ones, one on a Wednesday afternoon and one on a Saturday. And the youth one, my instinct was to do it at the end of school time, so that the school would bring them in as the last lesson. And, you know, so the kids got a bit of time off school. And the teacher would bring them.
Yeah.
But somebody said, oh, well, my 14-year-old couldn't come to your workshop. I was really disappointed, blah, blah. So the next one, youth one, I did on a Saturday. And the guy who's a youth worker came along, and that was it, not one youth. Whereas at the actual youth workshop itself, on the first round, I think I wasn't huge, actually, but there was... It was about 10 pupils. But what I did to compensate for that was I went out to the school and did some stuff in the school. So, you know, I was looking for where the gaps were and just saying, well, we need that. So, you know, being a bit open to kind of having to switch in and out.
But you had evening as well as daytime?
No, most of them were Saturdays. Most of them were Saturdays. It started at 11 to 1 and then at 2:30 to 4:30. And always with a tea break in between as well. So.
When you type them up, did you type them up into the visual?
Fed them into the timeline, so it became a linear process. Although, you know, I was looking at where they linked across to see if things needed to be transcribed or slightly adjusted to fit in and reflect, you know, what where they were impacting on other areas as well.
And did anybody else do a kind of modifying process on that
In the wake of all of this, all this material went back to the groups, primarily to the TTT groups, And only really two groups got very involved. One was the food group and one was the heart and soul. They were the two that really kind of ran with it. The economics group looked at what we produced and said, we don't like that at all, and wrote their own. But I actually, you know, bypassed them and went back to, I put their, what they produced and what we produced as well from the timelines, because I kind of felt that they hadn't really engaged in the public workshop side of it, and it would have been wrong to have dismissed what had come from the public processes. And particularly with, you know, the stuff that is very, you know, economics is so important as well, like the whole thing around consumption, and people like Friends of the Earth have got involved in that as well. So, you know, I felt that the economics group, I kind of, as I say, I overrode them. But so there was that opportunity to proof, but then this is the next stage, really, is the consultation. So this is we took it actually to the local foundation group to get the youth impact, and I took some photographs, which then they stuck post-its on. There's an art foundation course that follows on at our community college. They've got built an art foundation unit in there for a 1-year foundation course for art, which is very good. That year there were 13 students. So somebody from the arts group came with me and we did a visioning exercise, but used the photograph of the local area backed on to the map, and asked them to stick post-its on as what they felt it would be looking like. So it engaged them, and then we kind of asked them to add on to the post-its some ideas as well. So that was quite an interesting exercise, actually. Again, smallish group, about 13 of them, so they were quite confident to do it.
What happened if the information from different groups was different? Was it you that kind of drew it together and decided what was going to go in 2017 or what was going to go in...
It was, but because I took it back out to the community, this exhibition that we did, the draft exhibition, everything that had been pulled together was stuck up. It was, and some of it was visual with the post-its like that, just stuck on sheets that had come from those various places.
Okay, so even if you got different things from different people, they could still be under.
They could see it, yeah, and people could comment on that. They could write on it the way you do in consultation. You can say, oh, this is rubbish, or, oh, I agree with that.
Yeah.
There's about 350 people, I think, came through the exhibition, because I had it for a whole week in the Civic Hall. Yeah. And that's what the visions look like. What I did is where I typed them up, not the visions, the ideas for different parts of it and the backcasting. So these would be different years. So those years there... Yeah, you can see this. That's like from 2017 on the left, 2016, 15, yeah. 14. It was a huge exhibition. It was the size of this room. One side was all of these, and the other side was all the timeline, so that people could see where what had been sort of added in. Sorry.
Can I just get that straight? That's each column is a year, and each coloured strip is a theme.
Yeah, I'd, by that stage I'd got it divided into themes, so there were 15 themes. And the top one is, I think the top one was heart and soul. Some of them were food, there'd be biodiversity, water issues, community, building and housing, energy.
And those are actually post-its from the workshops?
No, they were where I typed it on. I'd not recommend this system, actually. I typed it on and chopped it up. I wanted it to look really like people could add stuff, so I wanted it to look a little bit kind of rough and ready. But I think that if I'd actually typed it up onto and sort of had it in sheets, it would have been... probably a lot easier, but also it would have been lot quicker. It was very, very time consuming. I mean, there was like, you know, thousands of them at this stage to sort of stick on. They did have better sticky than those post-its, but sorry.
You started your timeline in 2008.
Yes.
Have you met the targets that you set for 2009?
2008 and 2009 was primarily what we were doing. What people put in there, because we didn't set targets, we just asked people to put their thoughts in. And a lot of those things were things that were already happening. We need to look at what's happening.
I'm talking about the use of the timeline.
Yeah.
To achieve targets and set targets, so that you don't just say we're going to do this. You actually have to organise it to achieve those targets.
The one that we blew out on was Copenhagen. Because we thought that different things were going to come out of Copenhagen, so we were just going to publish actually at that stage, so we had to rewrite that bit rather quickly. But beyond that, most of it was actually things that were kind of within visible doing that were already planned and happening. So there wasn't a problem with that actually. So we had this exhibition. You can see it there on the right-hand side is the timeline and people sticking things on. On the left is the kind of the visual side as well as the written. And the reason that a lot of that visual stuff is the arts group kicked in on that and said, look, you know, we can't just have it all as text. It's got to be pictures. And a couple of them spent a couple of Saturdays with me just putting together pictures on the sheets to just kind of make it bring it to life a little bit. And then we had this 2030 cabaret night, which was brilliant. And these people kind of, people in the audience said what their experience had been getting to 2030. And this group acted it out. They had kind of like 5-minute sets of acting out what the stories that people told. They were an improvisation theatre group. Absolutely wonderful. So that was localised. We did consultation broadly using the localised website. I don't know if people were here last year's network conference, or the year before, when Peter Anderson talked about the localised workshops website he's set up, which is about consultation. So I used that to link in so people could comment on it. There wasn't that much public commentary actually at that stage. That was right across August and September of last year. But just to give people a chance to comment back, and it was like, put everywhere, it was all over the TTT website, so people could put their thoughts in. So it did, you know, everything that was going in at that stage, the draft, was open to consultation, and it did accommodate people's thoughts by and large. And that was it. So what I just wanted to say to you now was, just because I really want to move us on, because we wanted in the last section here to really look at implementation, and we want to kind of talk to you about implementation. And the question that's come up, and Amanda will talk about this in a second, is around the different places that EDAPs will be developed and applied. And that means that what we've done in Totnes, while on the one hand my sort of like remit was to not only create an energy scent plan for Totnes and District, but also a template that other groups could use, which is really important. That there may be parts of it that aren't really so useful for you, or maybe you've got some thoughts on that.
Can I just ask? I mean, I know that you started on what did you want in 2030.
Yeah.
So was there any assessment of what the current situation was, what was working, what wasn't working initially?
Only from the viewpoints that came back. I mean, certainly from what Sean said, we set a framework in the sense of like the things that we could kind of build from, the kind of information around the decline of oil, for example. So one of the exercises we would do was that, you know, at the moment, the average, well, 2009, the average UK consumption of oil was 9 barrels per head, and the expectation was that by 2030 it'd be 1. So that was one framework, if you like, and it's not going to be linear either. And that, you know, climate change, we can change, you know, who knows what's going to happen there, but, you know, if we carry on as usual, that's what's going to happen. So we had to kind of use the business as usual scenario for kind of what may happen as a background framework, if you like. But and certainly we looked at kind of other local plans. So there's lots of local authority plans that I spent quite a lot of time with to see where they were coming from, what their expectations were, because it was important to try and weave in things that might be relevant out of that. So that's your research, really.
Yeah, I think what's just fallen into place for me is that what you're doing is not merely and simply, but you are really focusing on the energy descent side. And because I guess I kind of want to do a combination of a local plan with the energy descent built into it. So you've actually got the local community plan and integrated with the energy descent plan, that you were trying to do that.
Well, essentially this is a local community plan. But it's a local community working through its energy descent.
But then you've got to assess what schools you've got, whether you need more or what roads you've got, where you want
them. It's massive. It is potentially a massive piece of work. That's why it's a fat book. So you have to be selective and pick out what are the essence of it. And that's not easy.
I just think the title is actually a bit misleading because it's much broader than energy descent.
Yes.
And I think the process is probably making it correct. But it's actually, energy descent, well, yeah, that's important. That's about renewable energy systems and those kind of things. That's even, without actually looking into the detail. So I think possibly the title doesn't actually give them what you look through the book. It's much broader.
Interestingly, one comment someone made who wasn't coming to this and said, oh, if you're going to that, can you tell them to change the title of these things?
To?
Something different. Something, I think something less, it wasn't quite something less depressing, but
we've had this discussion in our group endlessly, and ultimately it is energy descent we're talking about. We're going from 9 barrels to 1 barrel.
I mean, the thing is, I think, that energy, it's, we're not just talking about, you know, how do we do that energy descent, which seems to be what you're saying. It sounds like so much as the fact that energy is our ability to do stuff. That's basically what energy is.
And so if we're talking about energy centre, that has massive implications for transport and for health and for everything else. So the idea that an energy descent plan could only look at energy is misleading, and if the name gives that impression, but in fact, I mean, it sort of shouldn't, because everything that relies on energy, obviously.
Yeah, I don't think people see it.
Yeah. Well, this is why we actually entitled it Transition in Action.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that's the main title of the Energy Descent Plan. I mean, we wanted to obviously, I mean, it's a wacky great title, really, isn't it? Ridiculous. But, I mean, Transition in Action. And that is focused on throughout the book as well. And when you, as you say, when you look in it, you've got sections on community, sections on local governments, heart and soul. So it is actually looking as best we could.
So it's more like a community plan in the context of energy descent or something.
Yeah.
But
again, that's your local title. That's maybe a conversation to have with people, you know, that opens up the thinking.
And of course...
Yeah, just follow it up, sorry, but just speaking on that, and I think, you know, I've represented transition stuff as well, there's no way, certainly at the moment, we could do anything like what we've done, how great that is. And you say it's a template, but I think what would be really useful for a lot of groups, which are much more like the size of my group, would be something much simpler, and a much sort of simpler template, for something that actually people can do, you know, running a number of workshops and coming up with a plan in like the details that, and to actually use that as a template is quite difficult. And I've looked through the book and it's excellent book, you know, but it's not something that a small, slightly struggling transition group could take and run with in terms of what they could practically do.
Well, that I think leads on very neatly into
Certainly. Should
I?
Go on. Please do.
Okay, so I think we're going to give Jackie a break from talking now, because and so we're moving into the last, I don't know how long we've got left, something just under an hour or so, 45 minutes. Well, less than that, 40 minutes.
Half an hour.
Half an hour, yeah. So now, yeah, this is what... Sorry?
I'm supposed to go there at 5:30.
Yeah.
5:40.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was announced 5:30. We had to be back on there.
Oh, they've moved it back again?
Well, I don't think the end's been moved by 10 minutes.
Oh, right.
I think they expect the workshops to be 10 minutes shorter. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay, right.
20 minutes.
So yeah, we want to talk about people's experiences of trying to, you know, implement EDAPs and what's been helpful and what hasn't been helpful, and the differences between, as you say, the different kinds of transition groups and the different kinds of communities in which transition initiatives are embedded. In terms of the research stuff that you're talking about, the underlying research, as Jackie said, a lot of that at the national scale is in this book. So, for example, looking at, say, transport and looking at the trends, that how our transport systems have changed over the last 20 years and all that stuff is in here. But then, obviously, it's a case of drilling down into your local data. And for that kind of stuff, in terms of part, you know, your council and people like this will have pretty good data on that usually if you speak to them. And so that's a really good grounding for you know, your baselining in terms of then where you're looking on to what you want to do. Amanda, I don't know if you want to talk now about a bit your experiences in Nottingham and trying to do this on a city scale rather than on a market town scale.
Thanks. I'm really grateful to Sean and Jackie for giving us space to talk about this. It's a bit indulgent, really, to be honest. But we have been, as a transition group, emailing Rob and the other members of the transition group and hassling them and saying, look, we're really struggling on a city scale to do this, because you said early on that you need to define what your locality is. And at a city level, we find that incredibly hard. Is it the city within its administrative boundaries? Is it the city and how it sits within its hinterland with the suburbs around it? Then is it the whole of the city, and we've now got local groups, which are neighbourhood groups, and I confess, at the moment, they're not talking to each other and they're not talking to Transition Nottingham as a brand, so we've kind of broken down in communication as well. So I think there's a real issue about scale of implementing this kind of plan. So if you were to then say, right, okay, we could have a city-wide EDAP, but then the local groups each need their EDAP, and somebody quite rightly identified what a resource difficult and intensive process this is. The amount of time, energy, and one of my fellow transitioners loves the phrase, return for effort. And he suggested, is there not an easier way to perhaps do EDAP in cities? Could it be that we move to a more modular format and actually adopt some of the processes that Rob is currently doing with the pattern language? It might be that we need to think about moving it in that direction. So, another thing was that Rob suggested that we needed a critical mass to start the EDAP. When do you know it's time to be ready to start your EDAP? So we hassled him and asked him that, and he said, well, roughly when 10% of your population knows about your transition. And we thought, bloody hell, that's 60,000 people we've got to get to before we can even start. Okay, so, and we'd also had the arguments about, which I think you were alluding to back there, about what is this plan? Is it a plan that's got lots and lots of facts and figures? And you said the economists kind of rejected things that came back from the community. And I can say exactly, we had those two factions as well at the city level. So we had all these sorts of issues. For me personally, I think the scale issue is a really big one. So thank you very much for letting me, I guess, have luck.
Okay, so one of the big issues, I think, in terms of the evolution of the EDAP concept or whatever it might be called in the future, is whether it's a different process in different kinds of place. You know, whether there are city EDAPs and market town EDAPs and.
Go ahead. I went to the RHA, Renewable Heating Centre consultation at CAC. Right. And there was a chap there from Manchester, and he was puzzled by the fact that he was planning to use biothermal heat to heat Manchester, and the renewable heating centres didn't fit in with his, and whereas my group were thinking about small-scale stuff, he was thinking about something that was far more, had far more impact than anything we might do. And yet he couldn't find a way that this renewable heat thing would help him to do something that was far more radical in city terms.
Can we ask, can we just shall
we
get on with it?
No, this is a discussion period. So
is it
the whole point.
Just referring to the Nottingham experience, and some of these incentives don't look at that sort of scale. So it needs to be resolved.
I think one of the key things about a lot of this, though, is that what we're trying to create, both within the UK and beyond, is a kind of a sense of a jigsaw which fits. That's, I think, is the key to this. And I suppose with the EDAP itself, that's one of the things we looked at was food. You know, what does local food look like, and how does that look like if you spend that out? With the energy, the renewable energy budget, I use the CATS 50%. You know, we need to get down to 50% of what we're currently using in terms of energy, and that needs to be from renewable energy. And I know that's very difficult for groups to kind of come up with those figures and information, but it actually means that at least those are certain themes that are running through. And I think there's themes that you could pick out from the EDAP that we've written here that could be applied, like the basic areas for local governance and things like that. And yeah, it's always going to be difficult within the tuning, but I think one of the things that we've done in the last, I don't know, 30 years really as a society, is we've looked for simple solutions. Because we're so global, you know, and it's all the diversity is out there, we're looking for simple solutions at the local level that will fix it. If you turn that upside down and think, well, actually, if we look locally, the diversity starts to be beautiful, and that's what makes it really interesting, and it's actually okay. It's easier, it's less of a restraint. And, you know, again, it's about what's the local resources and what do we kind of need to exchange between our small areas of society. But I think in terms of the sort of, city, you know, if it's versus, or city or town or rural area or suburb, I think, you know, if you at least get a handle on your locality, and one thing that I would suggest is to look at the political demarcations, because at least you know that somebody else will pick the next one, and the next one, and the next one eventually, and you can at least say that you're not kind of making it complicated on that level. I know they keep moving the boundaries, or they're likely to again, but, you know, if you work with that kind of as a starting point, I think that really helps. And again, with cities, I mean, I was asking Amanda about Nottingham. I think you said you have 9 wards, is it right? 9?
No, 9 areas.
9 areas.
They're made up of 2 or 3 wards.
But, you know, think about it broken down to that, and I think that really helps you, because you can get really lost in some of the detail that kind of confounds us and stops us ever starting.
How did you distribute the information to people other than by the final show? Did you have any sort of free paper handouts?
In terms of implementation, we're just about to kind of go into that phase into Totnes. I mean, we've managed to get 3 years funding, and there's a job opportunity at the moment which hasn't been filled. So yeah, we did the launch, but at the moment it's ready to kind of that. The next stage will be at the moment we've taken it back to the groups and said start looking at projects that we could start building as things that we're going to prioritise and run with. But we need to go out to the local community again properly and beyond kind of publicising the launch that we haven't really done much yet.
How many books have you sold locally?
Locally, I would like to say, I mean, outside of locally, we've sold far more at the moment because it's been on the website, things like that. We've sold about 300 and through that means. Locally, I think we've probably sold, I don't know, 50 or something. But that's really, actually, without any effort, actually. That's just what people have bought. It's available in the local bookshops, and we're hoping that the press over the summer, I've talked to the local press, will actually do some, serialise some bits of it and things like this. So, that's work in progress.
A couple of things quickly. One is, do we need Energy Descent Action Plan, or do we need Energy Descent Action Planning? And how, if this is a difficult ongoing job, which I suspect is iterative and needs to be continued, do we need to think about this as core infrastructure? And would we do it in a slightly different way, or add to what you've done already, if we think about it in this ongoing iterative way? Second thing I'd say is kind of a plug, really, to say permaculture design has always been thought of as energy descent action planning in different words. Every permaculture design, the intention is to reduce the dependency on external energy and to produce more energy than you need so that you become sustainable in the long term. And permaculture is being used in whole communities to design whole communities around the world. And another sort of movement, if you like, is the bioregional movement, which has done a lot of work around mapping bioregions, mapping the physicality of a space. And I think permaculture, again, looks at the physicality of space. So this looks very much at what do we want. Permaculture says, what have we got and how can we work with it? And I think the more we can bring those two together in some sort of ongoing iterative process, the more likely we are to really achieve the sort of overall results. So I suppose I'd be keen to look at to see how can we do maybe another experiment now, which starts to bring in a permaculture design perspective. I don't know enough about what you've done to know how much that's been brought in, but I'd be very keen to support looking at that.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the EDAP, that, you know, the work that was done in Kinsale, Rob was a permaculture teacher at
college.
No,
I know, for sure.
You know, and it's really, it's underpinned an awful lot of how this
That's true, but my question is how much of the actual observation, the surveying of the land, looking at, you know, actually what have we got in terms of south-facing roofs and so on, how much of that is informing the plan?
And I think the critical question we've, as a group in this room, got to think about is, you know, what does the evolution of the EDAP concept look like going forward? I mean, do we want to, for example, start up on the transition forum that we can all get involved with and hammer out some of these things? Or, you know, do we want to... Because obviously the idea of this project is that it's creating a template, but maybe it's creating a template that's particularly useful in other market towns that have got the capacity to employ someone to do it, for example. But maybe, for example, there's a thing called Forest Grow EDAP, which they describe as a pre-DAP. Which is kind of their attempt to get a really positive visioning document out there without doing a lot of the, you know, in-depth planning work in an attempt to kind of develop that side. Whereas some of the cities are saying, maybe we don't need to worry so much about the visioning because, you know, the transition timeline, the Totnes EDAP have kind of got that vision and ours is going to look really similar. Maybe what we really need to get on with is the, you know, the practical planning side. So,
Did you find that you were almost following a critical path analysis process where there were interrelationships and certain things dependent on other things being done at certain dates?
Well, yeah, that's the sort of backcasting idea, is, you know, if we're going to get here, then what do we have to have in place by 2028? And if we're going to have that by 2028, what do we have to have by 2025?
So in a way, that...
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm really sorry if I've misunderstood this. But if it's an energy descent plan, have you asked the community to set the targets that they want to achieve? Or have you injected some desirable targets based on science, like the expected availability of oil and gas? We have.
We've kind of done the anticipated. We've used the sites as best we can for the framework. And on top of that, we looked at kind of demographics coming out of Devon County Council report. They expected 19% increase in population by 2031. That's one of their things. So, yeah, we did use information that was available like that.
So
rather than ask the community what they thought, we kind of built the kind of creative.
So basically,
did you inject that in
to
your workshops? You said these are the givens. What do you envisage because in the light of that? Is that how you did it?
Well, in terms of the oil, we talked about that in the workshops, you know, that the oil is running out. We allow the peak oil, declining resource to be a key one. We talked about the anticipated change in demographics, and we talked about, you know, the need to look at climate change and that we needed to act urgently on this. And what the likelihood scenarios could be on that.
That's what this is. This is kind of laying out the context within which we're going to have to decide our future, the non-negotiable stuff. And then it's a case of, you know, taking that to people and saying, right, given that this is the reality, given that, you know, techno-utopia just isn't realistic, we're not going to be able to do that because there are these physical issues. Given that, there is still a range of possible futures. You know, which one do we find most desirable, and then how do we go about planning to make it happen?
We were talking earlier about the EGAT wing in 2012, and that's really where visioning comes into the process in a sort of systematic way. And open space is higher up, but I really think that even if you're not going to do an EGAT, it's a really useful thing, because talking about energy, it is actually something that brings energy and positivity into the transition process.
Yeah.
And I think do visioning and backcasting should be out there with use open space, because, you know, did amazing things in our food group, and we had it in green bricks, and the discussions that came up, we had a timeline with certain givens on it, you know, people start here or start getting noticed here, and then some of the visions, you know, working out the time dependencies really produced amazing energy. Mm-hmm.
So
it's worth doing in and of itself. And also that thing about, once if somebody's heard a vision and had a new vision sparked by it, it actually changes your body chemistry forever. You never travel through your community in the same way. And if it's on the website, it can do the same for other people.
Okay, well, we're running out of time. It's unfortunate because we hope to have a much longer discussion, but there were lots and lots and lots of questions around the actual, you know, process of what was done in Totnes, which is fine. That's what people wanted to do. But, as I say, I'm wondering whether there's a useful way of continuing the conversation beyond today, whether we can, either I could get people's email, or as I say, I can just start a topic on the transition forums if you all know where those are online, based around this, and we can kind of continue talking about it there and the different scales that might be useful. And
I was going to add is, if people were really interested in monitoring the full Nottingham story in some way, it's on Bob's blog about 2 or 3 weeks ago. He actually posted the letter. But the email was sent, and then there are a series of responses from around the world which make quite interesting.
Well, should I start a topic on the forum and include the link to that in as the first kind of subject to kick it off? So great, thanks for coming, everyone. I hope it's been really useful, and you know where we are if you need it.